important question ever asked. Now there's a sentence for you. We're going to be talking about the consequences of the most important question ever asked. What is the most important question that was ever asked? What is the most important question that anybody can ever ask? And it's not, will you marry me? I know it's a very important question. What is the most important question? Well, we're going to be in Matthew 17, but to get the context for it, we've got to go back to chapter 16 in a moment. But I want to mess with you a little bit, and we'll do it bit by bit, okay? So can I have, do you have a controller? Can I turn the slides? I need to point at you. Okay, all right, I'll point at Issy. All right, you're the controller. Issy's in control of all things today. Okay, I thought it was the Holy Spirit, but never mind. I remember your wedding day. Yeah, we have some stories, don't we? Yeah, okay. How much is it worth me what not to tell the stories? A lot, okay. All right, well, stories later for anybody that wants to know them about Issy and Tanya's wedding. But let's first of all look at Matthew 17. And then we'll go back and look at the rest of it. So here's what we're going to look at today. It's Matthew 17, verses 1 to 13. And let's read that together. Now, we can show these on the slide as well, for anybody that wants to follow along with the text, okay? So I'll trust Issy to follow along with that. Verse 1. Matthew 17, verse 1. After 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John, the brother of James, and led them up a high mountain by themselves. There he was transfigured before them. And his clothes became white as the light. White. That reminds me of Issy's wedding. Issy wore a white suit to his wedding. Anyway, I said I wasn't going to tell any stories about... Oh, no, okay, I'm sorry. Anyway, verse 3. Just then there appeared before them Moses and Elijah talking with Jesus. Peter said to Jesus, Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, I will put up 3 shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. While he was still speaking, a bright cloud covered them, and a voice from the cloud said, This is my son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him. When the disciples heard this, they fell face down to the ground, terrified. But Jesus came and touched them. Get up, he said. Don't be afraid. And when they looked up, they saw no one except Jesus. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus instructed them, Don't tell anyone what you have seen until the Son of Man has been raised from the dead. The disciples asked him, Why then do the teachers of the law say that Elijah must come first? Jesus replied, To be sure, Elijah does comes and will restore all things, but I tell you, Elijah has already come, and they did not recognize him, but have done to him everything they wished. In the same way, the Son of Man is going to suffer at their hands. Then the disciples understood that he was talking to them about John the Baptist. That's our text today. Now, the most important question. Oh, look at the magic of this. Okay, let's see what... Can you turn it around so I can see the screen down there, if that's all right? Thank you, that would help me out. And so here we have a scene of what's called the Mount of Transfiguration. And we have Jesus up there with some of his disciples and Moses and Elijah and indeed the voice of God. And then they come down the mountain and we have an interaction of teaching. And so what we have is, let's see if this works. Okay, good. That's where we're going back to this. Okay, so now, having seen what's going on here at the beginning of chapter 17 of Matthew, now let's go back to Matthew 16 to look at the context and the most important question that was ever asked. It's here in verses 13 to 16 in Matthew 16. So what does it say here? It says, when Jesus was in the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, Who do people say the Son of Man is? Who do they say the Son of Man is? And they replied, Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others Jeremiah or one of the prophets. But what about you? he asked, "Who do you say I am? Who do you say I am?" Simon Peter answered, "You are the Messiah. You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." And I would submit to you that this question and this answer are the most important question and answer for anybody to question and answer. The most important question that needs to be answered by all of humankind is, who is Jesus? Who is he, really? Is he just a good person? Is he someone with unusual powers? Is he someone that has had just a message from God? Or was he, as we see here, more than a prophet? More than a miracle worker? More than someone with a message from God? More than that, as Peter answers, "You are the Messiah. You are the one sent from God, the anointed. You are the Son of the living God. You are God in the flesh," is what Peter is beginning to grasp here. He's beginning to get the point. The most important question is, who do you say I am? Who do we say Jesus is? And as we gather here in this hall, I'm guessing that the majority of us have already settled this question. We've already settled the question in our minds, in our hearts. Jesus is the Son of God. Perhaps for some of us here, we're not quite sure about that. That's okay. I'm glad you're here, and perhaps we can resolve it. But for many out there in the world, the question has not yet been answered. For some, they've not even asked the question yet. We need to help people ask the question so they can find the answer. Jesus was all about this question and the answer and the consequences of the question and the consequences of the answer. Because even those of us who sit here having resolved the question and agreed with Peter's answer, even for us here, we sometimes forget. Don't we sometimes forget about what this actually means? We know the answer. We've asked the question. But are we living a life that reveals, and a relationship with God, that reveals that we're continuing to recognize the significance of this question and this answer? And I hope today from Matthew chapter 17, this first few verses, that I can help us to, this, the Word of God will help us to understand the consequences of the greatest question and the greatest answer to the greatest question that's ever been posed. So we'll talk about three things today. If the title of our lesson is, "If Jesus is the Son of God, dot, dot, dot." That's your title. It's back up here. Where is it? Let's find it, in case you want to write it down. If Jesus is the Son of God, then what? If he is the Son of God, if he is Messiah, then what? Well, let's see. Three things today from this passage. If he is the Son of God, then point number one, Jesus is the last word. If he is the Son of God, then he is the last word. He has the last word and he is the last word. I think this is what's going on here in the beginning of chapter 17. They're up the mountain. They've been there. They go up there with Jesus, Peter, James, and John. And they go up a mountain, and I don't know quite what they're expecting. Jesus often doesn't tell his disciples what's coming next. He likes to keep them on their toes. It's a bit of an adventure. I think the Christian life is rather like that. You never quite know what's coming next. You go to church and you think it's all going to be normal, and then suddenly someone says something to you, or you hear something, or you read something in the Bible at church, and you're like, "Ah, my life has just been turned upside down." Have you ever had that experience? It happens, doesn't it? You know, and something happens at work, in our relationships, and anyway. So they go up the mountain. What are they expecting? We don't know, but they're up there, and I'm guessing the last thing they expect is to meet Moses and Elijah. That's not what they're expecting, for sure. And Jesus is transfigured. His face shines like the sun. The clothes become white as light. And then Moses and Elijah, they're having a talk with Jesus. And clearly, I think the three of them are having a good time, you know. Don't you think Jesus got on really well with Moses and Elijah? And don't you think he missed them? I mean, remember, he's been with in eternity, Jesus, before. I mean, it's stuff to do with time. It's a bit difficult to grasp sometimes, how he was in eternity and then came to earth and forward and backwards in... I don't understand time. I don't know whether Doctor Who does, but I don't. But anyway, I think he's old friends with Moses and Elijah. And you know, I think they're having a great time. They're on the same wavelength, aren't they? You know, Moses, Elijah, Jesus. I don't think it was like, how do you do, Moses? Yes, nice to see you. And Elijah, yes, how is one? And I don't think it was like that. I think with Jesus, it was like, he's been on earth now for 30 years or so, and he's been missing all the fellowship of heaven. This is the first time he gets to meet some of his old friends from heaven. I think he goes up the mountain and he sees Moses and he's like, Mo! Peter doesn't know what to do with the situation, does he? I don't think I would either. Lord, it's good for us to be here. Understatement. If, what should I do? Let me put up three shelters, okay? I've got a hammer and a saw here somewhere. Let me put up three shelters for you, Moses and Elijah. I've got to do something. I'll just feel a bit left out here, you know? And then the cloud, the bright cloud, covered them. It comes in upon them. The word covered is an ongoing word, meaning it's coming in and over. And then there's the voice. This is my son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased. And then the instruction. Three simple words in English. Listen to him. Do you think Peter and James and John would have listened to Elijah? I think so. Do you think they would have listened to Moses? Oh, I think so. Why Moses and Elijah? I guess because Moses sums up the giving of the law. He sums up God's word being given to humankind. And why Elijah? Well, perhaps the most warrior-like of all the prophets, the one who had the victory on a mountain, on Mount Carmel, over the prophets of Baal. Moses, of course, up the mountain as well, had a mountaintop experience at Sinai with the giving of the law. Two mountaintop type kind of people. And Jesus up there together with them having a mountaintop experience and Jesus being shown to supersede even Moses, even Elijah. Wow. And God says, Moses is great. And Elijah is awesome, but my son is here. Listen to him. If Jesus is the Son of God, then he is the last word. He is the one that we must listen to. He is the one that on that mountain was confirmed and revealed as God's Son. And we must listen to him. There have been many impressive men and women of history, some who have changed the destinies of whole countries, continents, or groups of people. And we are very grateful for great men and women of courage and wisdom, from whatever culture and religion and background they come from. But what the gospel teaches us is that Jesus has the last word. He is the one that we must listen to when all else is said and done. He is more impressive than anything that humankind can produce. Peter tries to produce a covering here, but his covering is ineffective, unnecessary, mistaken. It's nothing to do with faith. But then God's covering comes in. His glory, his Shekinah from the old covenant comes in over. And his covering is impressive. It is effective. And it is faith building. And if we want faith, we must go to Jesus. If we want to have the comfort of God, we've got to go to Jesus. And it is this that gives us the courage to live the Christian life in a secular world, in a world where we are attacked for our values and our ethics and our morals. It is the presence of God that reassures us and it gives us the courage, the faith that we need to persevere day by day and week by week, year by year, and for many of us here, decade by decade. How will we make it? We will make it to the end if we allow Jesus to be the last word. One of the books I've been reading recently is a book here called A History of Christian Missions. And it's, in one little book, a summary of 2,000 years of Christian missions, of all different kinds, of, you know, Catholic, Protestant, and Orthodox, and various things. And it's very, very interesting. And one of the things that's impressed me significantly is the amount of missionary work that was going on in what we call the Middle Ages. The Middle Ages was very much a dead period of Christian history for most people, in most people's view. But there were still great men and women of courage who took the message of Jesus to places rather more dangerous than Wanstead. Let's just, I don't know what you think of Wanstead, but let me just say there were and still are many more dangerous parts of the world than East London. And, you know, in say the 1200s, when you didn't have, believe it or not, a smartphone, and when there were no such things as rapid means of transport, there were monks and others going out into difficult places, dangerous places. There were some people who went to the Magyars, who were known to be ruthless and a deadly group of people. And they'd heard about these Magyars, and someone said, let's go and share the gospel with them. They're not Christian in their background or whatever. And they sent some missions out to these people in the 1200s. In 1235, a group of four missionaries was sent out to look for the original Magyars. The journey was terrible, and only one of the four reached journey's end. Of a second expedition, not a single member reached their destination. Nothing came of this mission, which was swallowed up in the next great disaster that fell upon the Christian world. It remains as a monument to the vision, courage, and pertinacity of the medieval missionary. Now, I don't know if you understood the word pertinacity. I need to look it up myself, but it sounds good. You know, the first three and then the next expedition, they all died on the way. I mean, in those days, it was dangerous. Bandits everywhere, diseases that we would now take for granted could be cured, but in those days would kill you. They were going from one part of the world to another where they didn't have their immune system was working for those diseases, and they went willingly to a people that they didn't even know whether it would accept the gospel, and in fact, it says it was just a disaster. But they went. Why would someone do that? Why would someone go? When there's no chance of success, there's no options. They would go because they're convinced, right? They're convinced that Jesus is the Son of God, that He's the last word, that whatever religious teaching these Magyars have, whoever they are, they don't have Jesus. They need Him because He is the last word. You know, when you know that, you persevere. Another thing that I read about was when the Portuguese finally got to what we call India today, they were very surprised to find 100,000 people belonging to the Christian faith. They were thought there was no one. It was just Hindus and Muslims and whatever. But they landed and they found 100,000 people cut off from the rest of Christendom at that time. They had persevered for maybe 1,000 years without contact with anybody else of Christian faith. 100,000 of them. How could they survive? Surely because they knew that Jesus was the last word. I wouldn't necessarily agree with the doctrines and the teachings of all the people from this book, or even at that time. That's not the point, I think. The point is, at least for us, that they were convinced that Jesus was the last word. And if we are convinced, then we will persevere, and we will live a life of faith. The first thing we see is that Jesus is the last word. I think the second thing we see is this, that Jesus is our friend. You know, if Jesus is the Son of God, and He is God in the flesh, then surely also He is our friend. I love the interaction here between Jesus and the disciples right after this amazing revelation on the mountain. When they hear the voice, the disciples fall face down to the ground, terrified. The word is phobomai, which is the word we get phobia from. They're terrified. But what does Jesus do? Now think about this for a minute. Most times in the Gospels, when the disciples cower in fear, when they're afraid, when they're scared, most of the time, what does Jesus do? What does He do? He rebukes them, right? He tells them off, He rebukes them, He corrects them, and He says, stop being afraid. Don't be afraid. It's a command. Most of the time, they get a rebuke. Why are you so afraid? Where is your faith? Right? But isn't it interesting? On this occasion, they're terrified. They're face down on the ground. Jesus comes, and He touches them. It's a touch. It's not a slap. Why are you so afraid? It's not a slap, is it? It's not a whack. It's a touch. You don't just touch people you rebuke, do you? I don't know about you, but when I rebuke people, I don't gently touch them. I actually know what I do. But I don't do that. I don't know. There's distance usually, right? In a rebuke, there's some distance. I don't know whether there should be or not, but there generally is anyway. But Jesus touches them. And he says, get up. And don't be afraid. I think it is partly a command. I think it's partly an encouragement. Don't be afraid. There's no need to be. Stop being afraid is actually perhaps closer to the phrase here. And when they looked up, there's no one there except Jesus. There's no one and no thing to be afraid of. Jesus touches them. You know, sometimes in the Christian life, sometimes the Christian life can be a little bit scary. You get persecuted. You get opposition. You have to deal with character issues, as Wale was sharing, you know. Sometimes friends, the so-called friends, bring up your faults. Sometimes your wife or partner, sometimes your kids, you know, they reveal things to you. And I don't, you know, it's scary when we're faced with the real us, the deep things inside, right, who we really are. Sometimes it's scary. The Christian word can be scary. But you know, the great thing, I think it's possible to be excited and scared at the same time and still hold on to your faith with Jesus. Because frankly, if I'm not scared at times in my Christian life, I think I'm dying. If I'm just everything's cozy and nice and normal and nothing's disturbing me, it doesn't have to be disturbing all the time, but at least from time to time, doesn't life have to be a bit scary? Or does we lose that vitality? And we also lose the connection with God because we don't really need Him to lead a comfortable life. So excitement and fear go together, don't they? It's like 28 years ago yesterday, I was very excited and very scared. I'll tell you why. Because 28 years ago yesterday, Penny and I got married. And yes, that is a 12-year-old Julie D'Souza there. Just having a look over there at Sarah and Hannah. How similar are the looks? Okay. And Julie's in the photograph, one of our wedding photographs, because Julie's the one that invited me to church, as many of you will know. And so I'm very grateful to her. But 28 years ago yesterday that we got married, and I still have my emotional memories of how scared I was and how excited I was. I only have to look at a picture and it floods back. And we went out for dinner last night, you know, and it's just wonderful to celebrate 28 years of marriage, but it comes about through going through something that's exciting and scary. Actually, has often continued to be exciting and scary in the 28 years since then, too, you know. That's a good thing. It's a good thing. You know, you go from junior school to high school. You're excited about the new school, but you're a bit scared. You go from high school to a college or university, and you're excited, but you're a bit scared. You then get married, and that's exciting and definitely quite scary, too. And then maybe you become a parent, and you hold that child in your hands for the first time, and you're like so excited and so scared, right? Both at the same time. And then maybe you have kids and they grow up and then they want to get married. And now you're even more excited and even more scared. Excited? Excited because you can kick them out. Finally they can go. And you can have some peace in your house. But you're scared too because now you have less control. And this is another person in their life that's going to suck all the affection away from you. Who are you going to be in their lives now? Anyway, but as a parent, not that I have any neuroses about that myself at all, but I have heard that this happens to people. And apparently, then it's exciting and it's scary, and then the day comes when you might even retire. Oh, and you're so excited to have all this spare time and so scared you won't have any money. and then we come to death. And for most people, there's no excitement about that whatsoever. Only fear. But with Jesus as our friend, we can even approach that end with excitement. Maybe a little bit of fear. But that's the blessing of being a Christian. We can face everything in our lives with that balance, that blend. We can be excited about the challenges. We can be excited about the things that even make us afraid. Because Jesus, He is our friend. I very much appreciate so many of us here. I know, or some I don't know. I know that, you know, we have to step out on faith so much into our fears. I want to encourage you to do so, knowing that Jesus is your friend. A couple that inspired me recently is Sebastian and Carolina Gowra, with us in the Four Rivers region up in the northwest of London. That's Sebastian and Carolina. And they left the fellowship last year and were restored at the beginning of this year. That's around February. That's their restoration. And they were restored, and that was wonderful. And they are Polish. And as you may know, the church in Warsaw was replanted in, I think it was July this year. And they were very excited about that, so they took a week off work and flew over to help with the first week of the evangelism and the first church service and all that. And they were very excited about that, and they went over and did that. And I was very impressed with that. I mean, they've only just got restored. And you know, you could be thinking, if you've just been restored, I've only just got restored, you know, I need to settle in, I need to, you know, I've failed once before, you know, I don't want to fail again, I think I should take it, play it safe. And you know, going on a mission team planting 4 months, 5 months after you've been restored, I think that takes quite a lot of faith and courage. But not only did they do that, they came back and they said, you know what, we've got 2 more weeks holiday booked in August. We were planning on having some other kind of vacation, but we've decided we want to go back again. So they bought some more tickets and flew over there again and spent the last 2 weeks in Warsaw. And that's their family holiday. They took their 10-year-old daughter, Gabriella, with them. Again, great faith. But you know what happened when they got there? The evangelist who planted the church along with the other group, he was away for 2 weeks. And he was the only one that could preach in Polish. He's Ukrainian, but he's got enough Polish to be able to preach. He went on a preteen camp. So Sebastian turns up, just been restored. Oh, bro, would you mind preaching for the next 2 Sundays? Not only has he never preached in his life, he's never done a communion, he's never done a welcome, I don't think he's even prayed on a Sunday at church. He's like, what? You want me to do what? I just came for a holiday kind of evangelism holiday, okay? I just gave up a lot already. I gave up my 2 weeks holiday to be here. What are you loading on me now? But you know what? He got his courage. We met together. I helped him prepare some lesson outlines and things, and he went over there, and the first Sunday he was there, there he is, preaching, teaching, in Polish, which he's never done before. Even though he's Polish, he's always spoken in English about everything spiritual. You know how, if you're in a different country, you're baptized. I mean, I was so proud of him, and of his trust in God. The second Sunday was coming, and he did that the first Sunday. The second Sunday was coming, and he's like, I'm out of my depth. He rang me, he said, Malcolm, would you come? I said, okay. So I jumped on a plane, and I went and did the sermon the next Sunday. And I was there last Sunday with the group, and there they are, a group of very faithful and, to me, very inspiring Ukrainian Christians in Poland, planting the church there. None of them are Polish. There's one or two Polish people in the picture there, but the mission team was all Ukrainian. And I admire their faith because they had to take significant salary cuts to go to Poland. Because they all had good jobs in the Ukraine. But because the Ukraine is not part of the EU, the kind of jobs they can get in Poland are very much lower kind of jobs and lower pay. And lots of them are family people. They brought preteens with them. They're not young singles who kind of, who cares? No, I don't mean who cares about you. I mean, you don't, like, hey, I'll go somewhere for a year. I don't care what I get paid. It doesn't, you know, you're, okay, I'm going to dig myself out of a hole there. So, but they're family people. And they've gone there, and they set up businesses and all kinds of things. And hardly any of them speak Polish. They've been learning it for a year, doing their best, but it's tough, you know? Why did they do that? I think they're willing to do that, to take a step of faith that's exciting and scary, because they know Jesus is their friend. Is Jesus your friend? He wants to be. When you're afraid, He wants to touch you. He wants to say, come on, get up. You're with me. We can do this together. But you don't need to be afraid. I know it's scary, but it's exciting, isn't it? Come on, let's do something together for God. So first of all, we see that Jesus is the last word. Second, we see that Jesus is our friend. And thirdly and finally, we see that Jesus is our teacher. If he is the Son of God, he is our teacher. The final part here we won't go into in great detail. But as they come down the mountain, Jesus, in verse 9, instructs them. Don't tell anybody what you've seen until the resurrection. The disciples say, why then do the teachers of the law say that Elijah must come first? And he talks about Elijah and him coming and what must happen. And then they realize, oh, John the Baptist was the fulfillment of that. Jesus is our teacher. We need him to be our teacher. They needed him to be their teacher. It wasn't just his presence. It was the fact that he taught them. You know, they're asking a question that goes back to Malachi chapter 4. I'm very impressed that Peter, James, and John knew enough about Malachi chapter 4 to ask Jesus a question about it. Do we know Malachi chapter 4? Do we know enough about the Old Testament to want to ask Jesus, what does that mean? Shed some light for me, Jesus, on some Bible teaching. We need to know the Word. And that way, Jesus will be our teacher. Jesus is the last word. He is our friend and he is our teacher. Let him be the last word for you today. Let him be your friend today. Let him be your teacher today. You know, this experience had a profound effect on Peter as he records it in his second letter. He says, "For we did not follow cleverly devised stories when we told you about the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ in power, but we were eyewitnesses of his majesty. He received honor and glory from God the Father when the voice came to him from the majestic glory saying, 'This is my Son whom I love. With him I am well pleased.' We ourselves heard the voice, this voice that came from heaven when we were with him on the sacred mountain." Peter is writing this probably half a lifetime later. But it's burned into his brain and into his heart because he was there on that mountain and he realized the implications of what he had said in Matthew 16 when he acknowledged, "You are the Messiah. You are the Son of the living God." And the consequences he lived out through his life, that Jesus for him was the last word. Jesus for him was his friend and Jesus for him was his teacher. Let's take the same attitude towards Jesus and his word today. One final story. A week ago Monday, we moved house, about 5 miles from where we are now. And we employed a removal firm for the first time ever in my life. And we had them come round, they packed all the boxes and everything away, and that was wonderful. And they did all the hard work. But partway through the packing, one of the movers was in my study, and he came out to ask Penny the question. He said, should there be some special box or special packing for this book? Do you want us to pack it, or do you want to pack it yourself, because there's the special book? And Penny said, "Well, what are you talking about?" And the packer said, "Well, the Bible." Because he'd seen this, my Bible, on my desk. And rather than pick it up and pack it in some old cardboard box, he wanted to check, since it was a special book, what should be done with it. It has a box. It does have a box. And it does go in its box. But you and I know that what really is significant about this book is not the paper on which these words are printed. But what's significant about it is that it teaches us about Jesus. It teaches us all that we need to know about Jesus. It teaches us that he is the last word. It teaches us that he is our friend. And it teaches us that he is our teacher. And with him, we will have the courage, the faith, and the ability to persevere through the rest of our Christian lives. To God be the glory. Amen.
I always love hearing Malcolm preach, and some very important stuff for me to remember. Although it's just three words, listen to him, it really impacted me personally, because I think often reading the Bible, some of the very important things, We can see what we want to see. I often find myself, when I reread something, realizing that I didn't actually recognize or notice that bit, because my eyes went to something I wanted to see. And very frightening when you go back and look at the words you were missing. I think these are the same words that Jesus is saying. But let me encourage us all to read our Bibles and remember that it's Jesus speaking to us. And the great thing, again, what Malcolm shared for me is, I think that knowledge that Jesus is a friend. He's not a harsh master. And sometimes when we read the Bible and hear some of his very strong and firm language, we don't see him as a friend. We think he's just trying to ruin our lives and get us to do things that we don't want to do. And how's that going to help me? And why should I live that way? It's too difficult. And yet when you see the fruit of living that way, you realize, actually, thank you. He's my friend. That was helpful for me to do that. And Jesus is also our teacher. You know, praying with my wife this morning and talking with some of the brothers yesterday. It's important to understand, I think, I have to understand that incredible point. Because I was speaking and talking as a member of the leadership team, I sometimes forget that I need teaching. I need teaching. I have a teacher. I need leadership in my life. I need to be open in my response to leadership and being taught, just as I expect others to be responsive to mine. But sometimes I've only focused on the other side. Are they responding to my teaching? Rather than, am I responding to the teaching I'm receiving? And Jesus is our teacher. Let me encourage us all to respect Jesus as our teacher. Thank you, Malcolm, for coming to the East. Always welcome. Let's stand and sing our final song for the morning. Praise is heard around the world. Feel free to loosen up. Amen. Lord, you love us. Let me get this right. Hold on. Found the way united.